A tragedy for science at Arecibo. We'll talk with the observatory director this week on Planetary Radio. Welcome. I'm Matt Kaplan of the Planetary Society with more of the human adventure across our solar system and beyond. You've probably heard the news. The Great Radio Telescope at Arecibo in Puerto Rico is no more. The 900-ton instrument platform, suspended by cables high above the giant dish, fell to its ruin in the early morning on December 1st. No one was injured, but any hope of salvaging the invaluable equipment has probably been lost. It was just hours before that I had recorded a conversation with Francisco Cordova, director of the observatory. That was after two cables had already failed, and after the National Science Foundation, which owns the facility, decided it must be decommissioned. You'll hear that there was still some hope when I spoke to Francisco, and hope is still alive. You'll also hear about the spectacular legacy of this unique instrument that has revealed so much and has played a role in the research conducted by so many astronomers and others. Planetary Society CEO Bill Nye will open our special coverage with his own reflection on Arecibo. First, though, we must take a minute to congratulate China. Its Chang'e 5 lander successfully touched down on the moon just hours before the loss of Arecibo. By the time you hear this, the spacecraft may already be collecting the 2 kilograms of sample material it will return to Earth. It's a complex mission, and some of the most difficult steps remain, but so far, so good. There's more space news in the most recent edition of our weekly newsletter, The Downlink. You can even hear the soothing sounds of interplanetary space. Okay, there's no sound in the void, but one of the microphones on the Perseverance Mars rover was activated en route and picked up some of the spacecraft's own appropriately eerie hum. You'll find it and much more at planetary.org/downlink. Bill, thank you for joining me on very short notice on what is really a pretty tragic day for astronomy, for science. We've lost a major tool for learning about the universe.
Yeah, and it's a piece of history, too. So everybody, the Arecibo Observatory's central receiver, I guess, was suspended by cables, all tension members for you structural engineering buffs, and they failed catastrophically, and the thing fell down onto the dish. I'm heartbroken. The place was amazing in a couple ways. First of all, visually, or as a place to visit, that anybody thought this would work and could build such an enormous instrument. And then the size of the dish is just dramatic. Idea, like it's in the movie Contact. It's in GoldenEye. It's just an amazing thing. But then the discoveries that were made with it. My heart goes out to everybody. And furthermore, the economy of Puerto Rico is infected by this. Ah, it's frustrating. My goodness, man. They took a valley, an enormous valley made of limestone, carved it out smoothly, mounted this giant dish thing in there, and hung a receiver over the whole thing on these massive cables. The biggest radio telescope complementary to Arecibo's in China. If you're a Cold War international competition kind of thinker, that's something to consider. Oh, yeah. I'm sorry. Thank you for asking, Matt.
Yeah, thank you, Bill, again, on short notice for joining this.
What short notice? This is a day in history. Come on.
It is, yeah. That's Bill Nye. He's the CEO of the Planetary Society. Visiting Arecibo has always been one of my goals. There's no telling now when that will be possible. It was midday on November 30th when the observatory's director and I talked. The news was bad enough after the August 10th failure of one long cable, followed on November 6th when an even more important one broke. Little did we know that the worst was still to come. I hope you'll agree that my conversation with civil engineer and Puerto Rican native son Francisco Cordova holds up very well, especially those portions of it that review the enormous contributions made by the Great Dish and why it is worth rebuilding or replacing. Francisco spent a number of years at Boeing as a senior manager before taking over the observatory. I should explain a couple of things he'll mention. Arecibo was one of very few facilities that was capable of using its enormous transmitting power to heat the ionosphere. This enabled research that has helped us understand the behavior of plasma in that upper layer of our atmosphere. You'll also hear him refer to the Gregorian upgrade of the facility. James Gregory was a Scottish contemporary of Isaac Newton, who designed a type of reflecting telescope. That design, now called Gregorian in his honor, was the basis of a substantial upgrade to Arecibo in the mid-1990s. Francisco Cordova, thank you so much for joining us on Planetary Radio. I only wish that the circumstances and our topic was a happier one, but we are very happy to have you join us to talk about what has happened, about the legacy of this magnificent instrument, and what you hope will be happening as we head into the coming years. Again, thank you.
No, absolutely. And again, thank you for the invitation, and happy to share some of the experiences that we've had here recently or before that. I think there's certainly a lot to talk about. So again, yeah, we really appreciate the invitation.
Oh, you bet. You know, our boss at the Planetary Society, CEO Bill Nye, he talks with pride about the role of his alma mater, Cornell University, in the creation of the observatory. He and all of us at the Society want to express our condolences to you, your staff, and all the researchers who depended on this great tool. It is at least so good to know that no one has been hurt through all of this. That must be a relief to you as well.
Absolutely. And so the safety of our staff is definitely our priority. It has always been our priority and will continue to be. From that perspective, you know, we do feel a sense of relief in the fact that most of these issues that we've had with cable failures and such haven't really resulted in anybody getting hurt. And again, that's our priority.
Yeah, thank goodness. Were you at the facility when either of these breaks happened?
No, I was not. And actually, very, very few folks have been here. Both of these breaks have happened fairly late, either in the middle of the night or in the late evening. At the observatory, we have about 130 staff members here. Certainly, you know, this year has been a special one with all the COVID issues and constraints. And so, you know, we probably have about half the staff working remotely these days. That being said, we do have sort of a skeleton crew here during the night that includes a telescope operator and our safety personnel. There are certain scientists that do stay also overnight to support a particular type of observation if needed. But typically, during those times, we'll only have maybe, you know, 5 to 8 staff members on site. And so I was not here for either of those failures. Certainly, I was called pretty early in the morning after the first one happened.
Were any of those staff on duty? Were any of them out there at the focus of the Great Dish in that amazing structure?
No. So this is such a massive structure. And so, you know, we can talk numbers. To get an idea, you know, it's 1.8 million pounds in the platform, the suspended structure, and it's 305 meters in diameter. You talk those numbers and they sound big, but you can't really, you know, absorb it until you've seen it and how big it really is.
Yeah.
From an operations perspective, you know, we run operations out of the control room, which is away from the primary reflector area. And then the security personnel also is away from that area. Actually, we do searches around the dish to make sure that there's nobody in that area before we do any high power transmission or any sort of thing like that. But no, we didn't have anybody in the area. We did have operators on site, and we did have our security staff, but we didn't have anybody else in that general vicinity, which was good news.
Probably a good thing.
Yeah, absolutely. Everybody knows the observatory, right? I think, you know, it's a historic facility. It's an icon of science for the entire world. But the true value of the facility is in the staff. I've never worked with a more dedicated group of folks. They are fantastic. And I am extremely proud of everything that they have been able to accomplish, especially in this last couple of years with so many challenges that we've had. First Hurricane Maria in 2017. Then we had other smaller hurricanes Before then, we were going through an environmental impact statement evaluation by NSF that they were actually considering decommissioning the facility. We managed to pull through that. Then we got into a rash of earthquakes earlier this year, followed by a pandemic. And so it seems like just a never-ending rash of issues for the facility, unfortunately. And we've managed to get through the majority of them until we had these cable failures that were just so unexpected that unfortunately couldn't be controlled.
I did a fair amount of reading in preparation for this, and I saw that really a tremendous amount of progress had been made toward understanding the first failure and recovering from it. You already had new cables on order. This must have made the second failure just that much more devastating.
Oh, absolutely. And so I guess the real frustration is, you know, we felt that the engineering teams felt they had bounded the problem to these auxiliary cables, right? So the first cable that failed was an auxiliary cable. That auxiliary cable was the newest cable that we have on the facility. We installed it in the 1990s as part of the Gregorian update of the facility. And the failure mode for that particular cable was very, you know, very surprising. It didn't fail in tension. It sort of pulled through the socket. We spent a lot of time first understanding that particular failure, making sure that we understood enough about the structure to feel safe working in and around those areas. A comprehensive structural model of the facility was built. And then just as we had a plan developed and vetted, right? Remember, everything needs to be evaluated by a National Science Foundation. It is approved by them. They have a set of consultants that reviews everything. Then, unfortunately, we have this other failure, which was completely unexpected. The second failure was the failure of a main cable. These main cables were the original cables that were installed in the 60s by the Department of Defense when they built the facility originally. There is significant degradation that's occurred on that particular structural system, which further complicates your ability to really be able to salvage the facility with zero risk. And so I think it's important to mention that. A lot of people have asked me, you know, why didn't we change this sooner, or could we have responded differently? Well, you know, there is a level of, first, you have to understand the problem, and the mandate had always been clear of, we have to have no risk to personnel performing the tasks in these areas. And in order to do that, in order to quantifiably measure safety, then we needed to take it step by step, and we needed to understand the capacities, and then we needed to understand the failure modes and determine those. And doing a lot of those things without being able to touch the hardware is very complicated. Finally, when we were ready to execute a plan, then we had this second failure, which has set us back.
Wow. There are so many more radio telescopes now than when Arecibo saw first light back in 1963. Why has it remained such an important instrument?
In radio astronomy, size matters. And so the size of Arecibo just makes it that sensitive at our given frequencies, right, than any other telescope out there. You know, there continues to be cutting-edge science that gets done here every day, and nothing has been able to replace that. When you're looking at the sensitivity, that's where Arecibo shines. That's number one. And number two, I think the fact that Arecibo is a multidisciplinary facility is one of those things that really makes it unique. You know, we have astronomy, we have space and atmospheric sciences, and we also have planetary sciences. The astronomy team focuses certainly on the sensitivity on the large collecting area. The planetary team focuses on the power of the planetary radar, which is the most powerful planetary radar in the world. There's not another one like it. The space and atmospheric sciences team has the most sensitive incoherent scatter radar in the world, as well as a suite of other equipment, including LIDARs, including optics, including remote observing facilities, ionospheric heating capability. I mean, there's just so much going on at Arecibo at any given time. And actually, that was one of our big operational challenges. So one of our big challenges was, you know, we have different communities. We have different capabilities. How do we find a way to create schedules, right, that we can fit everybody in? The uniqueness of Arecibo's and the value of a facility like this one still continues to this day.
I'm so glad that you mentioned the radar capability because our audience knows it very well since we frequently talked about how it has been used to reveal more about near-Earth objects, near-Earth asteroids, and saving our planet, perhaps, someday, as well as doing great science. In fact, it was mentioned not long ago on the show about until we can look at, I think it was Apophis we were talking about, that big rock that's going to pass by in 2029, how much people were looking forward to using your facility to tell us more about that big rock. That is a big part of what has happened down there, hasn't it?
Oh, absolutely. Even last year, we broke the record on the most near-Earth objects that we had actually pinged with our radar. You know, it's one of our key capabilities. There are other facilities that have other planetary radars, but they're not as sensitive as our Arecibo, so you're not going to get such a great resolution on your images. And there are other objects that are just too far away for other radars to reach that were within our reach. And certainly that has been, I think, a key mission for us here at Arecibo is supporting the characterization of potentially hazardous near-Earth objects.
Someone has created a Twitter account, Save the Arecibo Observatory, our at Save the AO. We'll repeat that again later. And it includes this charming little video that goes through some of the accomplishments of Arecibo. And they're read, it seems, at least if I heard it correctly, by children. It really, you probably have seen it, I assume. I mention this only because I'm wondering if you could single out, and it's not fair because, of course, there have been hundreds. Are there a few of specific discoveries made by the observatory over the last 57 years that you could maybe mention?
Absolutely. There's so many. It's always a challenge when I'm asked this question.
Of course.
And the reason why I say it's challenging is as I mentioned, we have three different communities. And every one of them have fantastic highlights. They've accomplished so many great scientific endeavors that it's always hard to pick. One of the first ones, the rotation rate of Mercury, that's always a big one that we have out there. Being able to detect the first repeating fast radio burst is another one, way more recent than that one. You know, seeing the first triple asteroid system. I mean, there's, again, every one of these has so many accomplishments, and I always struggle even to showcase it. When we're at conferences, I always get that question. And I always have a slide built that lists all of them, but there's so many that you can't really, The slide isn't big enough for all the stuff that I've got in there. But no, it's always amazing to read through the history of Arecibo and to realize all that has been accomplished and all that is left to be accomplished, right? And so that's something that I always like to talk about and say, you know, we've done great things. There's so much more that we could potentially do. There is such a big need for a facility like Arecibo as we go into the future that I think we have to find a way to maintain some of those capabilities. And if we're not going to be able to maintain them in this current setup, then should we think about how to reimagine the observatory for its second generation?
I just have one more maybe unfair question for you. What would you like to see happen?
Yeah, that's an interesting one. You know, many people ask me that, but not in that same way. it's hard to understand. Certainly, preserving the facility is something we would love to see, right? You always like to see finding a way to save it. But you know, being here on the ground, I also understand the safety challenges that come with that. It's a difficult decision on whether there is a willingness to take the risks necessary to stabilize it. But at the end of the day, the way I see it is either we find a way to stabilize it and save it, or we find a way to rebuild it. Because the need is still there. The need for a facility of this size, of this sensitivity, with these or better capabilities is still needed. That's what I would say is what I'd like to see. If we could save it, that would be great. I understand the challenges with that. So if we can't save it, let's build another one.
Hear, hear. Thank you, Francisco. I wish you the greatest of success, and I'm sure I do that on behalf of our audience and the members of the Planetary Society as well. And I look forward to getting better news, but we are very, very grateful for you taking this time to go over what still must be a pretty painful topic. And best of luck as things move forward.
Absolutely. Thank you, Matt, for the opportunity.
And I will just mention again, there is that Twitter account, Save the Arecibo Observatory, or at Save the AO. I've also, and there is a petition campaign there as well. I've seen the hashtag, Save the Arecibo Observatory, and hashtag What Arecibo Means to Me. And there are plenty of people who should be able to respond to that. Francisco, I'm going to keep it on my bucket list as well, because it has always been near the top of that list for me to make it to that beautiful spot and see this facility. So I hope to talk to you in person someday.
Oh, that'll be fantastic.
Arecibo Observatory Director Francisco Cordova. My conversation with Francisco covered much more than we have time for here on the radio. The entire interview can be heard on this week's show page at planetary.org/radio. You'll also catch more from Bill Nye and Bruce Betts about the observatory's loss. Speaking of Bruce, the chief scientist will join me for What's Up right after this break. This is Planetary Radio.
Hi, this is Kate from the Planetary Society. How does space spark your creativity? We want to hear from you. Whether you make cosmic art, take photos through a telescope, write haikus about the planets, or invent space games for your family. Really any creative activity that's space-related. We invite you to share it with us. You can add your work to our collection by emailing it to us at connect@planetary.org. That's connect@planetary.org. Thanks!
Hi, I'm Jason Davis, Editorial Director for the Planetary Society. Did you know there are more than 20 planetary science missions exploring our solar system? That means a lot of news happens in any given week. Here's how to keep up with it all. The Downlink is our new roundup of planetary exploration headlines. It connects you to the details when you want to dive deeper. From Mercury to interstellar space, we'll catch you up on what you might have missed. That's the Downlink, every Friday at planetary.org.
Time for What's Up on Planetary Radio. Bruce Betts is the chief scientist of the Planetary Society. We talk a fair amount about Arecibo and its role in planetary defense and learning about rocks out there. I wanted to give you a chance to comment on this loss of the Great Dish as well.
Well, it's obviously very sad for the science community, all the great science they've done over many decades, studying all sorts of aspects of the universe, of course, in planetary defense that's near and dear to my heart. They were one of only two planetary radars that were able to radar image and study the properties of near-Earth asteroids. And so the loss of Arecibo is kind of a big deal. Coming up this spring, there are observations of Apophis that were planned, Apophis the asteroid that'll fly by very close to the Earth in 2029. And the radio scientists in an Apophis workshop I went to recently were hoping that Arecibo would be back online, but now obviously we'll just be using Goldstone, which will get data. It just won't be quite the same.
I suppose we'll just keep monitoring the situation, as I told Francisco, and keep looking up. And so you can help us with that. What's up there?
I can. There's a lot of great stuff coming up in the next few weeks. In the evening sky, you have Jupiter, bright Jupiter, yellowish Saturn are getting closer and closer in the sky, and they will be closer than they've been in 400 years on the 21st of December. That's in the evening southwest. Before then, we've got the annual Geminid meteor showers, traditionally the best shower of the year, with 100 plus meteors per hour from a dark site. And there actually will be very little moon. It'll be almost a new moon, so it'll be a great time to observe that. That's peaking on December 13th, 14th, and will also occur a few days before and after. If that wasn't enough, there's a total solar eclipse on December 14th that will be visible from portions of Chile and Argentina, and a partial eclipse visible from much of South America. You can see planetary.org/eclipse. For more information on that. And then in the morning sky, if you're still awake because you're so excited, Venus still looking super bright over in the east. All right, on to this week in space history. 1972, the last human mission to the moon launched, Apollo 17. 1998, Unity and Zarya modules were joined together, forming the core of what would become the International Space Station.
Yay.
On to Random Space Fan.
Showing your age there, old-timer.
Well, yeah, well, sure I am. The Arecibo radio dish covered, I guess it still covers, about the same area as the White House and its grounds.
Oh, interesting.
I don't know, but it is random. They're about the same area, the dish and the White House, plus the fenced-in area around it.
Yeah, I think that's very interesting. I think that's a good analogy.
Big is the answer. We move on to the trivia contest. Mars Odyssey, longest continuously active orbiter around another world. I ask you, what spacecraft is the second longest continuously active orbiter around another world? How'd we do, Matt?
As a moderate response, and a number of people who made good guesses but wrong guesses. And here is more from our poet laureate, Dave Fairchild, in Kansas. It's okay to be the second longest up in space because we send them up to find the info, not to race. So Mars Express has been at Mars since June 2003. Like Matt and Bruce, it's quite a pair with good old Odyssey.
And we've been doing this longer than Mars Express has been in orbit.
Yeah, that's right. And not quite as long as Odyssey, though. Here is our winner. Mark Dunning in Florida is our winner. He says, Mars Express, still kicking since 2003. Tears for the Beagle Lander, which was released by Mars Express, made it to the surface of Mars, but not in one piece. Space is hard, and Mars is very unforgiving. He says, you guys help more than I can say. Thankful for Plan Rad. Well, thank you, Mark, and congratulations. You have won yourself that Spacefarer's Handbook by Birgitta and Urs Gantz out of Europe. It's great. I got the PDF version. It's terrific. And you can get the ebook or the physical one. We'll be sure to ask you which one you would prefer. What do you got for next time?
It's bittersweet, but I think it's an impressive thing. How many aluminum panels are in the Arecibo radio dish, the main dish reflector part? How many aluminum panels was it made of? Go to planetary.org/radio contest.
Well, that's very appropriate. We are going to make it worth your while to do the research. Here is a brand new, never-before-offered prize on Planetary Radio because it's a brand new product from Chop Shop. That's chopshopstore.com, where the Planetary Society store is. It's our brand new baseball cap with a nice, big Planetary Society blue logo designed by the boss, the CEO, over a star field. And then below that, in much smaller type, it says the Planetary Society. That's it. And you have until the 9th, December 9th, that's Wednesday at 8 a.m. Pacific time, to get us the answer to this one. Good luck.
All right, everybody, go out there, look up the night sky, and think about what you would point a planetary radar at. Thank you, and good night.
I think I would point a planetary radar at another planetary radar just to see what happens. But we can't do that now because there's only one left. We ought to take care of that situation. He's Bruce Betts. He's the chief scientist of the Planetary Society, who's wondering about the physics of all this as I speak, because he joins us every week here for What's Up. Planetary Radio is produced by the Planetary Society in Pasadena, California, and is made possible by its members who mourn the loss of any scientist or instrument of science. Mark Hilverde is our associate producer. Josh Doyle composed our theme, which is arranged and performed by Peter Schlosser at Astro.